This is the very first piece of audio that the radio producer Mickey Capper put together on a computer. Mickey took the piano part of Adele's 2011 Grammy-winning ballad, Someone Like You, and then he laid a slowed-down recording of a baby crying on top. Crying is, of course, a normal and essential activity for babies. When you slow down the baby's cry, it hits a more adult frequency. To me, this sounds more like a 22-year-old guy having a breakdown on a picnic bench than an overtired infant fussing in a car seat. And this would be a weird enough effect on its own, but replacing Adele's soaring vocals with the slowed-down baby takes it to the next level. The song, of course, is Adele's searing lament for an unrequited love. And when you hear this baby's adulterated wailing in place of the song's lyrics, it uncovers a deeper pathos. The baby becomes not just hungry or tired, but it becomes bereft. The voice is at once ridiculous and deeply, authentically anguished. From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist. I'm Andrew Leland, and on today's episode, we'll explore the extremes of the human voice, with an emphasis on screaming. To do that, we called up the essayist Elena Passarello, whose first book is all about the voice's outer limits, from Howard Dean's barbaric yawp to Marlon Brando's iconic wailing in a streetcar named Desire. Passarello spoke by phone with our contributing editor, Naila Orr, and here's Naila.
Elena Passarello is a writer and actor. Her essays are rich with smart, funny, insightful arguments on misunderstood cultural phenomena. Her work is what would happen if Joan Didion wrote captions for VH1's pop-up video. In Let Me Clear My Throat, her debut essay collection, she focused on the voice. When we spoke last month, Passarello and I talked about the physical and cultural aspects of the human voice and how they might be connected. We also discussed her new book, which does for animals what her first book does for the voice, exploring the mysteries, absurdities, and wonders of famous animals. From Lancelot, a goat passed off as the last living unicorn, to Leaping Lena, a Cold War-era racing pigeon, to Coco, the gorilla with a thousand-word vocabulary.
Yeah, I'll just get started. I'll do that passage that you emailed me about. This is from Harpy. Here is all I can tell you about what it sounds like when I open my mouth and scream. My scream moves through a body that has been in working order for over, should I change these? These numbers. This book is 5 years old, huh?
That would be cool if you want to, you know.
Maybe I will. I won't change the weight thing though. I think I've put on a couple of lbs, but I'll keep my old. It's like the old driver's license. All right, let me try again.
Okay.
Let me clear my throat.
Hi, my name's Elena Passarello, and I'm an essayist.
Kick it over here, baby pop.
Period.
should I
say more? Here is all I can tell you about what it sounds like when I open my mouth and scream. My scream moves through a body that has been in working order for over 39 years. It is a 5'6" 1/2" female body, around 140 pounds, and its bone structure appears larger than those of most women I see in the park or at the gym or in the market. Only one of these larger-than-average bones, a metatarsal, has broken, but this still affects the body posture and thus, according to some, the resonance of my voice. I think, however, that the warped state of the neck and shoulders after years in front of a laptop alters the sound much more significantly. 25.5% of this body is fat, and up to 60% of it is water. It is not without its tonsils or its appendix, and it has never been impregnated. And all of these things are a part of the sounds you hear when I sigh, sing, or say hello, or scream it. My lower ribcage circumference measures 35 inches after a very deep inhale, and 31 and a half inches after I've expelled all possible air from my lungs. I can hold my breath for as long as it took me to type that last sentence 3 times in a row, including a few pauses to correct typos. My neck is 13 inches around. My vocal tract and its surrounding pipes are probably 30 centimeters long. The cords that produce speech and sound are approximately 15 millimeters in length. They were white when I was born, but in the past 15 years, I've tinted them with lots of coffee, more than a little alcohol, scores of nights in smoky places, and a few hundred cigarettes. I spent 18 years in a house with heavy indoor smokers. I then spent 9 years in a city with a high level of pollution. The remaining 12 years of my life, I've breathed relatively cleaner air, and I've yet to acquire either asthma or respiratory allergies, which would add a new timber to the resonance of the cells in the body. That essay goes on to talk about the idea of a woman's scream in contrast with the idea of a man's scream, at least in America. And so it talks about these two kind of famous screams, a scream that a woman does in The Crucible, and then the big sort of thing is the scream that Marlon Brando does in the film version of Streetcar Named Desire. And there's this contest every year that's held around Tennessee Williams' birthday in New Orleans, where people stand under this balcony in Jackson Square and they scream "Stella" up to a woman in a slip. Or if you're a woman that wants to enter the contest, you can scream up to a man who's sort of dressed like Marlon Brando. And when I was writing this book on The Voice and thinking about women's screams and man's screams, I learned about this contest and I was like, what if I went down there and I screamed Stella? Because I think it's just a much better sound than screaming Stanley. So what if I went down there and I screamed for Stella and sort of recorded what it felt like? When I was preparing for the contest, I was basically just kind of like screaming in my car on the commute to and from my job, and then sort of getting disgusted by how limited my voice sounded, and then not preparing. So I got to New Orleans and I felt very underprepared to the point where I almost just like dropped out. And then the only preparation that I did was heavy drinking, which did the trick, honestly. Nobody in acting school should do this. I hope nobody from Juilliard is listening, but I wanted to feel what it was like to scream what I think is sort of the quintessential vocal moment of American popular culture, this Marlon Brando Stella scream, right? It's a very mimetic scream. I wanted to have that in my body.
Hey, Stella!
I think that scream says a lot about masculinity, and so I wanted to have, as somebody who identifies as female, I wanted to feel what it was like to sort of possess that. And I also wanted to kind of get in touch with this older, it's kind of like a dude who like sells used cars that used to be a quarterback. Like, I wanted to sort of live out my old days where my voice was something that was much more powerful and much more, I don't know, maybe admirable is the right word? Much more professional, at least. I love how in the film, if you watch the clip really carefully, he's wearing that t-shirt and it's wet. He doesn't rip it. We always think he rips it. He doesn't rip it. He's wearing that t-shirt and it's wet and it's sort of clinging to his torso, and he's screaming so significantly with so many of his back muscles. You can see the folds in the t-shirts on the sides of his abdomen shake a little from the how much of his body is engaged in making that sound. It just drives me crazy. It's so exciting. Maybe the Stella scream will last past Marlon Brando, right? Maybe it'll be like those kinds of bits from Shakespeare that people say now that they don't even know that they were a part of a Shakespeare play, right? Or, you know, like the milk of human kindness, or we have to be cruel to be kind, or whatever. Maybe it's the Stella scream that will keep moving forward.
You talk a lot in the book about the way in which the whole body works in concert to make loud noises or to make screams. And that was something I hadn't really thought about much before reading your book. And so can you talk a little bit more about the physiological effects of making loud sounds or screams?
people who research the voice, the voice is so interesting because, you know, it's not an actual locatable body part. It's really new in terms of the development of the human physiology, right? It's one of the more recent developments that we have. In order for us to have the apparatus that allows us to not just scream, but speak and sing and communicate vocally, all the things that we do that aren't just like basic roaring, we have to employ organs that are used for breath, right? The lungs, for digestion, right? The epiglottis, and then the musculature of the body, not just the diaphragm, which a lot of people talk about, but the back, the pelvis, the neck, that all goes into the production of the sound. So really, the voice has sort of just stolen all of these different systems and body parts to make an apparatus that allows us to do anything from me talking to you into this microphone right now to Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire. So there are all these really interesting things. If I can't remember exactly, but certain operas, opera houses have clauses that women do not have to sing during certain days of the month because of their menstrual cycles. People have done studies where they can hear strange things that you wouldn't, strange parts of your body that you wouldn't necessarily think contribute to the voice. They can hear those body parts in the voice. Like you can hear somebody singing with a broken foot, for example. And they think that it comes from this idea that before we learned how to speak, very, very loud sounds didn't just communicate, I am somewhere and I'm in pain. I am somewhere, they could communicate, I am somewhere and I am in this kind of pain. So the voice would move throughout the body to let another human know some distance away, not just that, you know, a lion is eating my foot, eating me, that the lion is eating your foot.
Let me hear you say, flavor, flavor.
In the acknowledgments of your book, you mentioned a friend who you call the best hype man this side of Terror Dome, Flava Flav. And so reading that triggered a memory in me back to the mid-aughts, right, when Flava Flav was enjoying career resurgence and he was screaming his name all over TV, you know, Flava Flav everywhere, you know. I also thought about the fact that this book shares its title with what I think is a hip-hop dance song by DJ Kool, which in turn comes from a Beastie Boys line. And I wanted to talk a little bit about hip-hop samples and whether or not select vocatives and phrases from hip-hop could qualify as screaming memes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think screaming memes are things to celebrate, right? I don't identify them just to say, hey, these things exist. I identify them because they, they have such a special place in my heart. I think there's something about screaming as unit of culture that can be replicated that it just fascinates me. It fascinates me the way that we listen to it. I think that there are things that are worth celebrating. And the replication of bites of extreme vocal moments in hip hop and how it transfers from song to song, from school to school, right, from era to era is an incredible transference. The easy rock and rob bass, that sort of, I don't even know if it's a scream, it might be an instrument. No, it's from the James Brown sample for
yes.
It Takes Two. So it's a James Brown whoop, right? That,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, right? Yep. Like that, I mean, if you think about the places where that's gone and the art that's contributed to and the way that it manages to shirk nostalgia, it's like an upper level screaming meme. The screams of James Brown and the way that they have sort of woven their way through hip hop culture is an essay that I don't think I necessarily could write, but damn, I will read that essay. Somebody should totally make that happen. The screams of James Brown showed up in Watch the Throne, right? Like they're in everything. I love the idea that he didn't just come up with the 1-2 and he didn't just have funky drummer, but James Brown's vocal extremity is a keystone part of hip-hop permutation. It's just fascinating to me. I have the hardest time writing about the things that I love the most. I just avoid it. None of really my favorite voices even showed up in the book, aside from maybe the Brando scream, because there's an emotional tint to my ability to look at the things that I feel very personally connected to. And, you know, like I fall in love with subjects. I wasn't that, you know, I was pretty ambivalent about Judy Garland until I found her concert at Carnegie Hall through a completely sort of roundabout research thing. And I thought, oh, she's really interesting because her voice is so imperfect.
I may cry, oh, 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 but no.
I just assumed she was like one of the greatest American singers because she had perfect pitch or because she knew how to cover her tones, or because she was incredibly fluid or she had an incredible range. And that's not it at all with her. And then figuring out more and learning more and more about her and the sort of cult that surrounded her, I fell in love with her. So, but yeah, that started from this place of kind of like, I don't know, you know, kind of ambivalence about her.
I've got a bit of a frog in my throat. I think I picked up an old fungi in Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm going to get a sip of water. I'll be back.
Coming up, Coco the gorilla tells a legendarily dirty joke. We'll be right back. And now, back to Elena Passarello.
I didn't have the relationship with Siri back then that I have now. Like, I feel like I have a relationship with a robot voice now that's, like, so much more deep and complicated. Like, I didn't have an iPhone when I wrote this first book. So
right.
Me and Siri, we didn't even know each other. And now, like, Siri accidentally went Australian on my phone. She thinks my name is either In the Don't Waity or Dad or Whitey. I can't get her to call me by my real name. And then if I want to ask her for directions, I have to ask her in an Australian accent. Like, she doesn't understand Oregon unless you say it in an Australian accent. And so, like, every night I have to be like, Siri, set my alarm for 6:30 a.m. And so my Australian accent is getting better because she's, like, broken. Anyway.
I was reading a little bit about Jane Barb. She was once the most famous telephone voice of all time through her work with the Bell Telephone Company.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try it again.
And I wonder about the human foundations of these AI voices, you know, from Siri to Alexa and all the other automated voices we've come to know. Did you encounter any of these stories as you were researching?
I did. I looked at some of the Bell telephone. We're sorry, your call cannot be completed at this time. Please check the number and try again. Well, the movie phone guy. I was really interested in trying to figure out the movie phone guy. The thing that sort of motivated me with that was I always know when my partner is talking to an automated voice thing on the phone because of the way he starts sounding like a robot, you know? English. Cancel my order. Like, he just, like, starts... It's kind of like that. And then there was this change at one point in automated. This is a real springboard for the essay. There was this change in the way that automated voices were being selected by different companies, where the automated voice would sound confused. You hear it all the time now. I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. Right. And I think I understand. Right. Now they are programming these automated systems to express a kind of emotional confusion or an eagerness to help or a hesitance. And that just blows my mind.
I was just going to say, like, the emotional ambiguity that you just mentioned with the automated voices, I recognize that a lot when I talk to Siri and I ask her to, like, find the nearest movie theater or something, and she doesn't find it, and I get frustrated with her, and then she, like, seems hurt, you know, she seems offended, and I can pick up on it in her vocal tone, and it's just it's kind of freaky, you know, it's just sort of humanizing the machine in a way that wasn't taking place, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, or like when your GPS goes, recalculating, and it sounds like they're saying, like, recalculating, you idiot, like,
right.
Like, when you miss a turn, recalculating. And it's not, they're not saying that, she's probably just saying recalculating. But at the moment when you're frustrated because your exit is just flying by and you have no idea in this foreign town how you're gonna get back onto the highway in the direction, recalculating, you just hear the clenched teeth of this angry, you know, backseat driver, recalculate.
Right.
Or, like, we'll be, like, my boyfriend and I will be, like, driving, you know, through, like, Pittsburgh is notoriously bad for GPS. And she'll be figuring something out. And I'll say, oh, but we could, you know, just take this back road. And then my boyfriend will be like, oh, she doesn't know that. Like, she's like, oh, she's that Moore. She doesn't know. She can't do it. She doesn't know how to drive in Pittsburgh. It's like, she doesn't know anything. She's nothing. She's a computer. You know, you don't. Yeah. Anyway.
Animal Strike Curious Poses came out in February from Saraband Press. Can you explain the concept of this new book?
Sure. It's a sort of modeled after a medieval bestiary or beastiary, those books of beasts that sort of were in a lot of monasteries and libraries in medieval Europe that sort of gave facts about different animals that were both around the regions where the books came out and very, very far away. So you'd have a sort of encyclopedia entry about a beaver, and then you'd have another entry right next to it about a giraffe. And there was often a lot of misinformation in these bestiaries. My favorite piece of misinformation from a bestiary is that if you run into a beaver and the beaver knows you're trying to hunt him, he will bite off his testicles. So that's like a natural fact of beavers. There's actually a lot. There's a lot of good product in a beaver's testicles, she says at Oregon State University, like castor oil and things like that. So they're a very valuable part of the beaver. But so that's in there, along with sort of really basic facts like, you know, beavers have long flat tails that they use to slap the water to scare you away. And so I made my own bestiary of animal celebrity. So it's a chronologically arranged collection of essays, each one covering one animal with a name that we have sort of recorded in some way in the historical record that has piqued our imagination. So some of the animals in the bestiary include, it starts with a yuka, a woolly mammoth that recently fell out of the Siberian permafrost. One of the first North American females in space was a spider named Arabella, who spun a web on Skylab in 1973. So there's an essay about her. I think Coco was the very last essay that I wrote for the book. I was really excited to write about her because she was a really prominent part of my childhood. Coco is one of the primates, the large primates that were taught sign language in the 70s and 80s. There were a few of them. And she's very famous for being on the cover of National Geographic holding this little orange kitten that she purportedly named herself, All Ball. So she's maybe the only animal with a name that has then given another name to another animal. When I started looking deeper into the Coco project, the Coco experiment, which has, you know, been going on for 40 years, Coco's the only animal in my book that's still alive. The research that I found was a little dubious. I don't mean to say that we should, you know, that it's a condemnable practice. I'm still kind of confused about it, but it's hard to really know exactly how to codify the kind of speech that Coco, or the kind of communication that Coco engages in. And right about the time that I started working on the essay, this Greenpeace commercial came out with Coco, where she was signing, and then there was this caption below her where it made it seem like she was having all of these thoughts about abstract concepts like global warming and climate change and environmentalism, and that's certainly not something that Coco does. So I felt kind of hurt by how misrepresented she was. And so I took that hurt, and I took Coco's purported 1,000-word lexicon, the 1,000 words and word pairings that she knows how to sign. And I used it to have – I was figuring, you know, if they could put words in her mouth for that commercial, then I can put words in her mouth. And so this is Coco the gorilla telling that vaudeville joke, that dirty vaudeville joke, the aristocrats. Coco the gorilla tells a famous joke. You have to imagine, by the way, that I'm like a 1,000-pound, 40-year-old gorilla telling this joke with my hands. So just everybody imagine that. Okay. Coco the gorilla tells a famous joke. Father gorilla, mother gorilla, baby gorilla, hungry, need work. Mustache man tell, what work? Father gorilla tell, really together show, fine show, good practice, lights off good. Mustache man tell, hurry, give me. Father gorilla tell, hello, do mother gorilla. Hello, do father gorilla. Together dance, clap people. Father gorilla harmonica. Mother gorilla clown time, clap people. Hello, do baby gorilla. Skateboard do, puppet dance do, clap people. Father gorilla kiss, mother gorilla kiss. Gorilla hug, mother gorilla nipple find, clap people. Nipple kiss, nipple rub, nipple pinch, nipple slap, nipple on bottom, nail clipper nipple, many, many nipple touch. Tongue nipple, nipple sandwich. Mustache man tell, who nipple? Father gorilla tell, all nipple. Now, father gorilla, mother gorilla, peekaboo pickle. poke stomach, peekaboo pickle with pat bottom, with walk up my bottom, pull out hair, nasty time, mean love, mother gorilla leash on pickle, skateboard ride do, clap people. Mother gorilla find baby gorilla, little noodle pull, zip mouth shut, strangle tadpole, mayonnaise necklace, father gorilla there, sit father gorilla, thirsty father gorilla, mother gorilla strap on, baby gorilla sit, mother gorilla all peekaboo pickle, trouble pickle. Baby gorilla get Ingrid. Hello, do Ingrid. Ingrid turn around, baby gorilla wrestle, Ingrid trouble, devil, Ingrid you bad dirty toilet, Ingrid, Ingrid pudding do, Ingrid laugh, Ingrid eat, Ingrid sick, mother gorilla taste, bottle match, Ingrid electric pudding, Ingrid get father gorilla, pickle bottle match, peekaboo pickle on fire now, Ingrid whole smoke ring blow, mother gorilla whole blow harmonica, father gorilla dance, balloon on noodle, baby gorilla clown time, balloon on tadpole, Ingrid hole, smoke smoke, around together skateboard do, smoke noodle, balloon harmonica ride, all harmonica hole, play purple rain, all mayonnaise rain, all finished, thank you. Mustache man tell, wow, what name show. Father gorilla tell, we wonderful snob people. Mustache man smile frown, drapes. Yeah, I don't know, Naila. I think that might be wildly inappropriate for the radio.
Elena Passarello's new book, Animals Strike Curious Poses, is out now. That piece was produced by Jenny Amint and Naila Orr. The Organist is produced by me with Ross Simony. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny and Naila, along with David Weinberg and Mike Dodge Weitzkopf. Our intern is Aaron Pelish. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White. We're mixed and engineered at KCRW by Mario Diaz and Kat Yor. Thanks to Mickey Capper for letting us use Someone Like Baby, which you heard at the top of the show. It comes from his podcast, Sidewalks. You can hear more pieces like that at sidewalks.xyz. And if you like this podcast, the best way to support it is by leaving us a rating and a review on our Apple Podcast page. And if you're stumped about what you might say there, check out this recent podcast review from listener Chelsea Martin.
You don't seem to use Facebook anymore, but there are some messages waiting for you there if you ever decide to log on. Some of them are kind of humiliating for me, but I still hope you'll read them. I miss you. I reviewed all the graphic novels that came out this year on Amazon. Some old ones, too. You'd love this one, Janine, I wrote. Let me know if you want to borrow it. I even Instagrammed Ash Shaw's new one. Have you seen it? I think you really would love it. I'm hoping this message finds you. The Organist was your favorite podcast. Is it still? I remember coming over once, finding you silently crying in your living room, Miranda July's voice filling the space. Apparently, she had said something on her Organist interview that touched a nerve. You told me, Miranda said she feels like her own servant, and I realize that's how I feel. It's like I'm always trying so hard to make myself happy, but nothing is ever good enough. Everyone on Yahoo Answers says I need to move on. But how can I move on when everything in the world reminds me of you? When I can't help but put more things into the world, hoping you'll somehow find them, that you'll somehow find a way to click the like button.
In addition to this podcast review, Chelsea Martin is the author of 5 books, including Caca Dolce, Essays from a Lowbrow Life, which is coming out later this summer from Soft Skull Books. We're taking a break next episode. We'll be back with a new one on June 29th. Thanks for listening.
I heard that you're settled down, that you found a girl and you're married now. Your dreams came true. Guess she gave.